Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Our guest today is the Seattle Data Guy. Introduce yourself.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Rogajan, also known as the Seattle Data Guy.
What's your background?
Well, my overall background has been in data for about, I think, like the last 6 or 7 years. I started originally working at a hospital, kind of in BI work. So doing a lot of Tableau. That's when I first got introduced to concepts like data warehousing and ETLs. Eventually moved to a healthcare startup that focused originally on, honestly, dental data, and then kind of focused bigger picture, eventually more on just the healthcare in general. And then eventually, or at the same time, I also started a data science and data engineering consulting company. So that's led me to work for companies all kind of around everything from transportation, healthcare, insurance, finance, SaaS, just about everything. And yeah, and then also worked a little bit in big tech.
So that's kind of where the Seattle Data Guy comes from.
Yeah, yeah. So Seattle, you know, Seattle Data is like, I grew up in Seattle my whole life. And so, yeah, that's where I kind of came with it. It kind of has a catchy ring to it, I feel like it. Like, so I just went with it as far as for consulting, yeah.
Now, we talked a while back, and I recall that you're a transplant now. You're no longer in Seattle.
Yep. Well, yeah, so I moved down to the Bay there for about two years to work in tech at the Bay in SF. Currently, I would actually say I'm temporarily homeless, only in terms of I don't have a steady apartment to live in. I've kind of been doing every like 2 months here and there with this whole remote work concept being thrown upon us.
So kind of like a digital nomad.
Yeah, sort of like a digital corporate nomad, right? Like I have a full-time job as well, but you know, that's where they said work from home, but they never defined home, I think so.
Well, no, I think that works out well, especially with the current, you know, health issues around the pandemic and things like that. One of the things that we do, in fact, we're about ready to go take another trip, is we have a schoolie. And if you don't know what a schoolie is basically a school bus that's been converted into an RV.
Okay.
And we're about ready to head down to Tombstone, Arizona, Joshua Tree National Park, those types of things. We'll be gone for about 3 weeks, and we'll be working the whole time because the nature of work from home is so different now. So tell me something, you know, what's something that you're passionate about, something that's not technical? I mean, we can talk data all day long, and we're going to get to that, but let's hear a little bit more about who's been.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that, you know, I will tell people that I used to do before I got into data was I worked in fine dining for about 5 or 6 years from the time I was like 16 till 21. That's what I thought I was going to do with my life until I realized, you know, my wages went from like $10 an hour to $15 an hour over a period of 5 years. And, you know, just realized that wouldn't give me kind of the life that I was hoping for. But yeah, so I really did like cooking, and I still do. I don't know if since being from Seattle, you know, I ended up cooking for restaurants like Cafe Juanita and the Herb Farm, if you haven't heard about them. But yeah, that was what feels like a lifetime ago at this point.
Is there a particular cuisine that you specialize in or that you favor?
I think I started out with Italian, so I tend to really love Italian, like Northern Italian food. So it tends to be very pasta and fat heavy. But also the last place I worked at was like a little more new American. So it was a lot of like very modern, but also kind of contemporary food that would always like take twists from more classical flavors kind of concepts.
Okay. Well, as you know, this podcast is, you know, a command prompt production. And one of the things that command prompt does is Postgres consulting. But in an effort to kind of broaden the relationships that we have with our team members as well as with our clients, we're actually putting together a cookbook that we're going to be printing and shipping to all of our you know, all of our best clients as well as our team members. And it'd be great if you had a particular recipe that you don't mind sharing that's kind of close to your heart if you wanted to be kind of a contributor or contributed chef kind of thing?
Yeah, no, I'm sure I can think about one of the recipes that I really enjoyed back from the day, and I'd be happy to share it with you guys.
That'd be great. All right, so let's talk a little bit about data. I mean, that's why we're really here. You know, it's a big conversation now. The industry has exploded, obviously, with the amount of data that is out there, the types of data, the collection of data and everything. What does your consulting business really do?
Yeah, so my consulting business focuses really on being an end-to-end data solutions consulting firm in terms that, you know, we get you from raw data to some sort of final product, typically, whether that's data warehouse, a machine learning model, a statistical model, a dashboard, whatever it might be. In particular, I think I've focused mostly in that smaller medium range for businesses to try to help them really take the data that they have that they've been collecting oftentimes for 5, 10, 15 years and see what we can do with it. You know, I think that's been my major focus and really trying to like almost act as like an auxiliary data engineering or in data science kind of employee, you know, because oftentimes I find that, you know, if you're a $3 to $15 million business, maybe you don't have the budget to hire a full-time data scientist and data engineer, but maybe you need someone who is very kind of broad and can kind of help you along that whole process. And I think that's where I've really focused in trying to fit in.
You know, that's interesting. I think that as a small business, especially if you're not in necessarily tech, right? You're not in data. A lot of times you wouldn't necessarily know what you've got, right? You, like you said, you 10, 15 years of data. They may not understand that they have trends for where their money comes from, right? Who's actually giving them the money? Maybe a market trend has been created over the years through word of mouth or whatever, where a certain type of customer keeps coming to them. They're different customers, but they have maybe the same culture or they're in related fields, and they may not even put that together. Is that a idea of what something you might be able to provide?
Yeah, I think that's an aspect of it. I think there are other aspects, like, you know, maybe there are operational inefficiencies. Like I've seen examples where, you know, one customer had like so many services that they had kind of added those services over the years, and then those services have clearly started to cannibalize each other. You know, just like, you know, they're putting more money in, but they're getting, you know, barely the same money out that they were before. So I think that like that's an aspect of it. Yeah, I think another aspect is like understanding your customer better. Like when I've helped the SaaS providers, like it's more focused on helping understand what customers are spending time on their services, what features are being used, kind of what things that they do that were helpful and, you know, created more stickiness for the product. What things did they do that either detracted or provided zero stickiness for the product? So even things like that, you know, I think there's a lot that can be said and a lot that can be done, even with the data that you think is very little. I think there's a lot that can be gained from it.
Okay. So tell me, you know, obviously, probably everybody's tired of hearing about COVID at this point. But did your business change? Were you impacted by the pandemic?
I think the yes and no in terms of I don't think I was majorly impacted, right? Like, you know, consulting kind of goes on. If anything, right, like more people needed help, you know, more people are looking for cost efficiencies, more people are looking for ways to maybe make new businesses. That was something I saw where, you know, a lot of companies I was working with suddenly shifted and tried to figure out, you know, hey, before I had a business that was, you know, 100% people, with contact with people. And now it's like, I can't do my business at all, right? Like I had clients who went from 100% to 0%, you know, in a week. And so then they try to shift and figure out, okay, what can I do that maybe I can either develop something with what I have to develop some sort of product, like to help consult with other companies with the data that I've got and all these different kind of questions. And so I think that was definitely a lot of the shifts that I saw, as well as just the shift to like cloud in general. You know, I think for small businesses, I helped a few companies kind of shift more of their data and infrastructure over to cloud because, you know, it was a good time to do it. While they can't go in the office, they can now still run their business while being away from the office. So,
So let's talk about that a little bit, without giving names, of course. Is there a success story that you're particularly not necessarily proud of, but it's something that you weren't expecting and you were able to turn it into something that was great for a client?
Let me think. As far as like not expecting, I don't know if there was anything I wasn't necessarily expecting. I think last year some of the more success stories that were kind of cool were one was helping a company kind of develop a content categorization and then dovetail that into a recommendation kind of system where they had been doing a lot of this content curation and categorizing very manually with like a team of like 4 or 5 people, and then just developing a model kind of using a combination of like AWS Comprehend and some other Python kind of tools, and just using that to develop a topic modeling system that then could categorize things better, faster, obviously. Like there's no longer a need to have 4 or 5 people running it, and then implementing that into their overall architecture, so that they could again reduce the need to have 4 or 5 people do this kind of mundane work, right? Like it's not exactly exciting work to read all this content and then categorize it, and then also just provide kind of more accurate categorization as well as kind of more not finite but like specific categorization and really break it down. So I think that was kind of a fun project because it clearly had a very clear impact, and also, yeah, technically it was fun. So,
You've brought up the cloud a few times. I've been doing this for a couple of decades now, and so the cloud is, for me, it's just another marketing term,
sure.
right? It's stuff that we've been doing since the mid-90s, and frankly, even before, if you were in the market back then. I'm curious, do you, as someone, I mean, you mentioned yourself, that you started in fine dining. So you've been in the industry, and then you switched to tech and data, and you've been in this industry for a while. But what's your perception of the cloud? I mean, do you have any, let's say, privacy concerns or data ownership concerns, or what is it about? I mean, I think that everybody recognizes now that the cloud is a way to offload things that you couldn't offload before, whether it be systems engineering in terms of having reliability engineers or something like that. And even to some degree, you don't necessarily need a DBA, even though we find that that's a marketing ploy, not what is the reality. What in your world do you find it might be not just a positive, but also that, there's a pro and a con to everything. So for you and dealing with data, what is the pro and con of data in the cloud?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question. I think you're obviously, like you said, like the idea of anything quote unquote cloud-ish or some, whether it's time sharing on mainframes or whatever it might be, has been around for a long time. As far as concerns go, I think that they should always exist, right? Like I think it was like 2 years ago where there was the whole, I think it was Capital One got like an AWS engineer literally like looked into Capital One data when they shouldn't, obviously, because again, I don't know what their plans were, but they did. So I do think there's that relinquishment of control, but I also think in theory, hopefully, the cloud hopefully provides almost better security, right? Like we're definitely running into problems. I think right now, as far as older systems, especially older companies are running into like security issues with their systems just being older. So hopefully the cloud can, provide a more secure area as it's easier to kind of update in one place rather than multiple places.
Oh, yeah, I was going to bring up just in Amazon's defense, it is their policy not to touch data.
Oh yeah.
That was ro that was a rogue
Oh
employee, just for our listeners. Just to throw that out there for them.
yes. This was definitely not this was definitely nefarious by the employee and not Amazon's doing. And that person was like fired and et cetera. So overall, again, it should in theory have better security. I think the biggest thing, like you said, there is that it's it's kind of, in some ways, offloading a lot of the work that you used to have to do. Like, if you're into streaming data, right, like having to set up and manage Kafka clusters before, I think, was very times, you know, very painful and very difficult. Whereas now, it's not necessarily completely pain-free, but it's definitely a lot, I think, a lot easier to use either Kafka's managed service or AWS Kinesis and just kind of spin something up that way. Versus, again, having to understand a lot of other things. Also, another big thing, right, like, especially if you're a big company where you're constantly having to buy new servers, you get to kind of avoid that whole process of, like, how long is it going to take to get a new server if you need one, right? Like, often it takes however many months to just talk about it and then procure it and then set it up and then, you know. Whereas, you know, I can just flip a switch now and say, hey, spin me up the, you know, a 3 terabyte, you know, Postgres instance or something crazy like that, just as soon as I want it.
Well, so that's interesting that you bring that up. I hear that often when we're dealing with our clients is, you know, one of the things that they like is, you know, boom, push a button and we've got it.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the items that's forgotten though is one, it still costs money.
Yes.
Right. And so there we have, you go in and then all of a sudden there is 40 servers and you're not even sure what each one does.
Yeah.
So you're paying all this money and then you have to pay someone to come in and figure out what they do and what's needed and not needed. So there is definitely not just a financial cost, but there is a labor cost that has shifted to managing these resources. The other downside, and I'm not knocking developers. I love developers. I employ developers. But developers have a tendency to chase what's in front of them. And whatever's in front of them can change at any moment, which means they might deploy a resource, develop something for that resource, and then they turn left to deploy another resource, and they develop something for that resource. And then all of a sudden, we have what's called microservices, and you have to manage all of those. And, you know, a lot of people have been concerned that the cloud is going to, you know, remove jobs, right? We don't necessarily need, a Kafka administrator, someone who's truly intimate with Kafka. We have this service that we can deploy. But the problem with that is you're not getting rid of jobs. The jobs are just shifting.
Yeah.
You still need people who are technical that understand the technology. And I really think that a lot of the apprehension about the cloud is that people didn't want to learn new stuff, right? Everybody already had a working stack. It was either Java or it was Python with Django or whatever. They had their database, which should be Postgres. If it's not, switch to Postgres. You know, they had their operating system, which was Linux or Windows or, you know, even Mac OS X for that matter. And shout out to FreeBSD just because it's awesome. And then all of a sudden, and what felt like overnight, even though it wasn't virtual hosting anymore.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't co-location anymore. Now it was rented servers and it was the cloud and it was instances. And now we have serverless and we have microservices and things are shifting so quickly that I think that a lot of people kind of just stood there like a, you know, a doe or a deer in the headlights, trying to figure out where everything was going.
Yeah.
All right. So what markets, actually, before we get into that, you know, we looked at your website, you know, we vetted you a bit before we decided, hey, this guy might be kind of interesting to be on, have on the podcast. You appear to be fluent in a lot of languages and databases. Number one, as someone who's technical, you know, I understand that once you know, say, Perl, it's not that hard to switch to Ruby. Python might throw you a little bit because of the white space indentation. Or if you try to go to Lisp, right? Those are slightly different paradigms. But language for language, you know, if you know C Sharp, you can go to Java without a whole lot of, you know, leap. What would be something that you found challenging between the technologies that you're currently, let's say, a practitioner in?
I guess I'm curious in what sense. I think it's often the challenging thing is like, and I think you kind of almost talked or just mentioned this in your kind of discussion about cloud is that it's more about like picking the right sets of technology that I think can be the hardest thing. I think a lot of the technology, like one reason it's easy to have so much like more like broad understanding of technology these days is because a lot of it, it's not been simplified in terms of like, it's not necessarily that much easier to use than it has been in the past. It's just that, you know, Python personally is so much simpler than Java, right? Like personally, it's like running code, at least starting it, is very, very easy to get started with. But then it's more about, okay, but what's the right tool for this job that I have? I think that's generally the hardest part. I think you mentioned, I don't know if you, when you said, you know, developers tend to chase what's in front of them, if you meant more like the trend in sense of like, what's the coolest thing. And I think that remains true, right, for not just developers. Well, developers of all kinds, right? Data scientists, data engineers, data programmers. I think they all kind of chase the trend. And I think it's, for me, I'm always trying to focus on, okay, well, what's the right tool for the job that I'm using? So that's generally why I think I have so many different aspects that I, or different skills that I've kind of developed over the years, is because I've approached so many different problems and used so many of the right tools for the right things and tried to use the wrong tools for the, you know, wrong things occasionally. And you start to kind of figure out, okay, where does this belong in kind of a high level architecture? So I think that's generally the hardest part, right? Because I think oftentimes a lot of the more low level things, like, you know, coding an API, right? Like that's pretty like well-defined and you can find how to do that and you can, you know, learn how to do that pretty quickly just through documentation and things like that. But, you know, knowing how that then fits in an overall architecture, I think tends to be a little harder. And thinking that big tends to be a little harder because it's just so easy to get, especially as a programmer, just to get in the weeds and try to answer, solve this problem, this technical problem, that whatever it might be.
So what's an example of a problem that you approached and you worked on it for a while and then you just kind of sat back and said to yourself, I am using the wrong tool?
I think there was an example of where Kafka's coming up again, but this happened like 2 years ago, where like a client wanted to use Kafka for some streaming of log information as well as like errors so that they could automatically like ping it out to their clients on some various integrations that they had developed. And so like at that point, I was just like, okay, they asked me to do this thing, so I'm going to do it the way that they've asked me to do it. And you know, after spending, I think like a week or two doing it, I was just like, wait, why am I even using Kafka? Like they had said, use it, but I was just like, can't we just, you know, put it in the code that, you know, when this kind of error comes up that we'll send it out and, you know, send it to the integration that we want. And so I think that was kind of one of those instances where I was like, you know, really looking at the problem, what they were actually trying to solve and not trying to look at the tools that they were trying to use was kind of that moment for me where it was like, I just sat back and I was like, wait, why am I even doing this? That's not what they're trying to solve. No. They don't need it. So
I know that feeling. I've been in plenty of meetings where my favorite is, you know, when you're on the phone with the CTO, who's clearly brilliant, right? It's not an issue of whether or not he's brilliant, but because he's the CTO, he is so busy. And something flashed across his screen. It could have been anything. And then we have to have a call about microservices or serverless, or you know, the current common one is we must move to Aurora. And my response, and it's not that Aurora is a bad implementation. It's not, it's great. But I always have to bring them kind of down to earth. I'm like, what is the problem that you're trying to solve? I'm like, Aurora is faster. Okay, but you're not having performance issues. Right. So there's often, you know, you run into these situations as a consultant where you're kind of staring at the wall, wondering where they found the solution, because it's clearly not the solution to the problem that they asked you to solve. What kind of markets you're in data science, right? So that's not what we're talking about. But do you have a particular type of customer or market that your customers are in as a preference?
So I think in general, I it tends to be that small, medium company, you know, somewhere that $3 to $100 million size that, you know, maybe they don't have a data engineering team or maybe they do and they're overwhelmed. And they just kind of need someone to come in and kind of play that pinch hitter, you know, really kind of bring a project either to a point where they can hire then a full team or have me kind of manage it. If they're generally, if they're smaller, you know, I manage a few companies kind of like data warehousing solutions that I've spun up for them. So that tends to be where I fit. I tend to kind of be that IT guy, I think, that a lot of people have, but I think a little bit more so. I think like every small business has that one IT person, but that's generally where I target. It's never like, I think there are a few industries I'd like to work with more. Like I haven't got to work with finance, and I think that's always been an area I'd be interested in working in. Personally, right now I've worked a lot in healthcare and insurance, and a little bit in transportation and SaaS. So it's more about the size of the people than I think the industry that they're in.
Okay. Is there a key marker that you find, something that's kind of a red flag or an orange cone that says, whoa, when it comes to an efficient data team or an inefficient data team? Something that, a recurring trend that when you walk into a problem, if this pops up, whatever this is, you know that the challenge may be a little bit more than what was alluded to originally.
I don't know if it's specifically like about the data team, but like I think oftentimes, at least what I've had happen a few times at this point is, you know, you'll come in to kind of maybe like some, especially some of my earlier projects, you'll like come in to automate some sort of process or, you know, do some sort of data engineering work. And you suddenly realize that this thing that they're trying to automate has so many data sources on so many different granularities on so many levels that you're just like, you know, I think the first few times I've definitely tried to do my best on it, but it's just one of those things that is such a beast in the sense of like, you know, you might have like 15 different data sources and, you know, three of them come from online, three of them come from internally, two of them come from, you know, some sort of Excel that a team puts on a shared drive once a month, maybe. One of them is a number that's just a percentage that then is calculated using to output all this other information. And I think that's happened a few times. And, you know, you're just sitting there like the first time you're like, yeah, we can totally solve this. And the second time you're like, do I really want to solve this again? Like, this is such a hairy mess that you've developed and a process that you've developed. It's similar to like some ETL systems that you come in and then you look at it and it's like, one cron job somehow manages 300 pipelines and they're like all just timed somehow to not run over each other. You know, it's just like, oh God.
Well, I actually hit the nail on the head there, which is something a lot of businesses don't understand, is that generally speaking, their problems aren't unique. Yeah. Right now the data may be unique, but the problems themselves, you know, we're all human and humans tend to have similar general skill sets, right? Especially around business, where a small business may be very good at making chairs. That doesn't mean that they are very good at, you know, managing the inventory of dials that they need to make those chairs. And that could be any business, right? They're good at their particular brand of business. But there are inefficiencies within the business itself that can be improved, especially around data. I mean, as a data company, one of the things that we're constantly trying to do is decrease the amount of data sources we have and have canonical locations for the information we're looking for, right?
Yeah.
And it's a constant battle. And I think that's a battle that, you know, every company has.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you think that a lot of business owners miss when it comes to data, right? I mean, most businesses understand, you know, watch the P&L, watch your profit margins, watch your expenses, make sure sales are up, right? That's all kind of business 101. But usually there's something underlying that, you know, a lot of people overlook. Have you seen anything that's kind of come to task?
Trying to think specifically or a few examples. I mean, I think what's always interesting is trying to just connect context, right? Like trying to figure out if they have information that can provide a little more context to that P&L. I think there's things that they miss.
Well, what would you mean? Like when you say context, is it say, the reason you're only making 2% on this widget is because you are processing a part of the widget through seven different departments when it only needs to be two?
Or is it something else? I think that's generally a good aspect of it, right? Like I brought up cannibalization earlier. It's not like with that, you know, that business had the information about kind of the different products that they were offering, and then you know they could you know easily take that and then sum it all up and get their kind of P&L and things like that. But you know, if you were then to go dig into, hey, why is my P&L not going higher, or maybe it is going higher, but it's not, like, you're maybe not paying attention to like how much higher it's going per service you're adding in. But you have that information there, like you have, okay, these are the services that I'm currently providing, and you know, am I making more per person than I was before, or more per service than I was before? It's like, oh no, in fact, it's dropping. So yes, I might be making, you know, more in general, but you know, now I'm having to run six or seven services where before I was only running four. And you know, that information is often, especially if you've got some sort of ERP, which again, some of these companies, even if it's not necessarily like Workday, have some sort of ERP, that information is probably there in some way, and you could probably look into it and start to find a little more context on like, well, what's actually driving my business? I think you brought that up, like, what do my customers actually want? And I think that information can exist and often does in a lot of businesses. So I think it's just they either don't know to ask the questions, and I think that's one big thing. It's like, okay, what questions should I ask, right? First being, you know, what's actually driving your business? They just don't even, I think there's that's kind of a missing point there.
Well, that's interesting, because I think that rolls into our next question, in that, you know, from a business perspective, and especially as a consultant, you know, one of the things that we do, and when I say we, I'm saying consultants in general, is that we give advice, right? We're paid to give advice. What is a piece of advice that you would give any company, right? It applies across the board. Any company starting down the rabbit hole of managing their data?
Yeah, I think my biggest piece of advice is always start with, your goals. And in terms of like, make sure you have clear goals that align with your business goals that, you know, that will help you drive your data portion of it. You'll often have, you know, clients, especially, I think you brought this up with like the CTO or something, you'll have clients come to you with like, they read an article or something, and they get very excited about like using AI or something like that. And it's like, but does that align with the rest of your business? Is this kind of going with what you're trying to do as a business, right? So I always say first step is try to make sure whatever you're gonna do with data, it's gonna align with your business goals, right? Like you're not just, it needs to connect somehow. Cause that's gonna drive the solution that I'm gonna try to create. Like maybe you don't need a data warehouse. Like that could be a whole extra amount of work that's not necessary. You just kind of need some sort of report or something that's, you know, put out every once in a while. And you know, since your database is so small and untouched, you know, we can figure out how to do that without, you know, completely copying over everything. Or maybe you want to build some sort of ML model that will, again, improve your categorization and things like that. Well, then you're probably gonna have to process that separately, and you don't want to be interacting too closely with things. So you're gonna need kind of a separate area. I think that's usually my thing, is like, my first step is always like, okay, well, what does this got to do with your business? Whatever you're trying to do with data.
I think if we distill that down, it kind of boils down to, what is the problem you're trying to solve?
Exactly.
And then the flip side of that, because you brought up, you know, the CTO that reads the article and gets excited. First off, I love CTOs that read articles.
Of course.
And get excited, because that means they're going to pay you, yes, to do something, right? But, you know, one of the advice that I give is, just because we can doesn't mean we should. There are plenty of things in this world that we can do that we probably really shouldn't. So what do you think the bottom line is? Do you think that we are in a position now where data is literally invaluable, where the people that are utilizing data in their business are going to have an edge over the people who are not looking at their data?
I think, as long as, you know, when you say that, as long as it's, you know, in a methodological way, in a way that's like actually, again, aligning with business, I think the answer is yes, right? Like if you are making choices and decisions on your with your limited resources, based off of data, you're more likely to succeed because otherwise your option, right? Like everyone's just got limited resources. And I think that's a lot of the times what data does is like, it just kind of tells you where to focus those limited resources, right? Like where's a problem or where could I make more money or where could I reduce costs, and having that information, and being confident in acting it, I think often is beneficial. And I think the other side is, you know, there's a lot to be said about like data being valuable in terms of being able to sell it, not in terms of like just selling raw data. I mean, selling like insights to people. I think at this point I've worked for a few companies that like, that's really all they did. You know, some company would give them data and they would have some sort of, you know, cookie cutter dashboard system that would process it and then give them results. And that's all that they did. And these companies, you know, that's how they made their bread.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that we're starting to get into, you know, at least for my concern, for example, you know, okay, Google, hi, Alexa, hello, Siri, you know, that's all data collection. And you have to wonder, you know, certainly they're popular services now. They're not in my house. But I'm old school and I already know that, you know, the NSA knows exactly where my phone is, and is probably listening to this as we speak, because I said NSA. But, you know, beyond that, what are the implications, you think, of all this data that's no longer in the control of the private citizen?
I think it's one of those things where it's somewhat obviously concerning. I think, you know, like you said, I think the NSA has been listening to us for forever. And in some, like, it's one of those things where it's like, does that make it okay? You know, I think for me, it's less about the data that I'm concerned with. Like, obviously there's concerns with that. I think in general, I think a lot of these things, the bigger concern is how it kind of drives other cultural movements. I think that's generally where I usually am a little more concerned, right? Because again, like a lot of these algorithms, they just kind of show you what other people like you have watched, and then suddenly everyone is thinking the same way. And so I think that's generally my bigger concern. Not to say that privacy isn't a big concern. I honestly assume that like my life is too boring, and hopefully, you know, we won't get to a Big Brother point where, you know, they're trying to control us with it and they're just using it for marketing. It's like, okay, if that's all you're ever going to use it for, that's fine. But I think it's once you cross that line, it gets more concerning. But I think, again, for me, the bigger concern is how that data is then fed into algorithms that then feed us like very like groupthink process, like things, right? Like suddenly we're like, why is everyone thinking the same? Oh, because we're all literally reading the same articles, looking at the same pictures, you know. There's like so little, like that information is passed so quickly and suddenly everyone thinks in a certain way. And it's crazy how I think that happens so quickly. So yeah, I think that's my bigger concern over data collection. Not saying that there isn't fear about data collection, but I think that's the bigger concern.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I mean, what a lot of people don't think about, you know, let's say you're on Amazon.com and you're shopping for a new whatever. Right. For example, in our household, we're big fans of different kinds of blades, right? Whether it be Damascus steel pocket knives or, you know, Japanese carbon steel, you know, meat cleavers. It doesn't matter. We like different blades. But what will happen is that we leave Amazon and we go to whatever Google News, or we log into whatever social media because we have no life. And then we're presented with this ad, and the ad is directly related to something that we were, you know, viewing on Amazon. And it could be, for example, what happens to me is I get things like, clubs where you spend say $50 a month and they send you a box, and the box has all kinds of survival kit stuff in it. Which is cool because it's directed at me and it's clearly pointed towards things that I was consuming already. But on the other hand, I don't know that I want people to know unless I want to share that information.
Yeah.
Right. Yet clearly someone somewhere knows that I'm into blades. And that I think is the more concerning part, is that we have become, as a society, so driven by what's on the screen, whether it's your computer screen, your phone screen, your Xbox screen, whatever, that it is a little manipulative, right? It's no longer, you know, back in the 80s, I can't remember the movie, but there was a movie, and I think it had Dustin Hoffman in it. And he played a marketing exec. And he wanted to do truth in advertising. And so he came up with this whole marketing scheme for Volvo. And the scheme was, they're boxy, but they're good, right? Truth in advertising. And a lot of people couldn't get behind that idea because, you know, boxy but good doesn't necessarily sell. Well, now it's no longer the psychological peaks within advertising to try and get you to buy something, like, you know, if you buy a truck, it's sturdy, it's, you know, four-wheel drive or whatever. If you buy a Porsche, it's fast and that type of stuff. They're able to nuance the message delivery because of the data they now have access to actually trip certain triggers within you specifically, right? It's not a category like men 18 to 35. It's that person. And that, to me anyway, is a little bit terrifying. It scares me that large corporations, good or bad, right? I'm not suggesting that they're actually trying to do anything bad, but that they have this ability to drill down into our most base desires to a degree that they can get us to buy the one red widget, not the blue widget, which is the same thing. It's the one red widget. And that's a little concerning. We're actually getting toward the end of our podcast here, but I did want to bring something up. We had a current event recently. And I will say, had I been willing to spend just $19,000, had I been willing to spend $19,000 in the process of 2.5 weeks, we would not be having this conversation because I would be retired. And that was the Wall Street Bets and GameStop. There was a lot of content on your Twitter feed about this. What are your thoughts here?
No, I think it was definitely a fascinating thing to watch. I think the big thing that I really found fascinating was just watching the growth. Again, you watched, I think back in March 2020, their group went from, like, I think it was, it basically took them 2 months back in March to gain 200,000 members. Then, you know, it took them like a week in January, then it took them a day, then it took them 12 hours, then it took them a few hours. And so watching that exponential growth, I think, was fascinating. Again.
Are we talking about the subreddit, or are we talking about the growth subreddit of the stock?
Well, yeah, basically they probably trailed each other there for a little bit. But yeah, no, more the subreddit, like just watching everything from like the daily active posts and how that increased and the comments increased and the just overall, like, attractiveness increased. I think it was fascinating. It's an interesting, I think, experiment on, human behavior. Also, I think it's also very interesting in terms of, like, you know, epidemiology studies, obviously disease, but it also, I think I've seen a lot of studies is like the passing or dissemination of information. And so I think that was like an interesting thing, just to watch this thing double and double and double and how quickly it went once the rock started to roll. And, you know, people started talking about it more and more. So I think that was fascinating. I'm curious to see what comes of it. I think in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, whether it stays kind of niche after this, right? Like, because maybe it didn't do the thing that everyone wanted, so everyone will just ignore it now. Or if maybe, you know, it becomes a place where people actually try to, you know, find new information, where, like, maybe hedge funds start scraping it to figure out before people buy what the next it stock will be, and then they'll just, you know, play it to their advantage. Or, you know, I'm curious to see what'll happen there.
Well, I think that there's definitely, you know, there's a couple sides to this. I mean, obviously a lot of people, even some famous people, were very, you know, go, go, go on this because it was the little guy taking on the big guy. But on the other hand, in the process, and this is the way the system is designed, but in the process, a lot of people lost a lot of money. People's jobs were put at risk. And you created this mob mentality about investing into a stock. And the problem with the mob mentality is never smart.
Yeah.
Ever. And so there were people within there, I have no doubt, that watched it, got in, got out, and made a killing. And now they're trying to figure out how to deal with capital gains. Good for them. But in the same vein, there was absolutely people who, you know, losing $50,000 is a lot of money.
Yep.
And it may cripple them financially. And, you know, I don't know that regulations are necessarily the way to go about that. I think it would upend the system as a whole. But I do think that there needs to be a more open discussion on both sides, right? Not just from your, you know, someone who gets on Robinhood or TD Ameritrade or whatever and just starts pumping the stock. That's you know, one concern. But on the other concern, why are we allowing these funds to, for example, short, right? Why are you allowed to, and because that's gambling, right? That's not investing, that's gambling. You're saying, I'm betting that you're going to lose value so that I can get rich. That's not investing, that's gambling. And I think that there's a certain level of thought that needs to be put around in the markets about whether or not we want to allow that kind of behavior. Because that's not what stocks are designed for, right? Stocks are designed as an investment within the company, and hopefully in return, you can make money back, but it's not a guarantee versus something that is, hey, you know, we know you're going to fail, so we're going to get rich off of that. And that just seems incorrect. It seems like the wrong way to approach, you know, people in general, because, that's what we're talking about here. Lastly, because I just want to wrap this up a little bit. You know, it's been great talking with you. I would actually like to do this again. I'd like to kind of dig into some more of the, you know, data privacy and democratization, social issue type stuff around data at some point. I think that'd be a lot of fun. And of course, at Command Prompt, we're constantly dealing with data and Postgres. You know, that's the services that we offer. And so we run into all kinds of weird regulatory issues, whether it be, you know, financial rules or HIPAA rules, things like that. You know, there's certain companies where only our U.S. team is allowed to work with the data, things like that. Did you have any further thoughts before we close this out?
I don't think I have anything specific. I think, it's been great kind of talking to you. Gaining a little bit from you as well. Like, you know, I know you were asking questions, but you definitely provided a lot of interesting insights just from your side and your experience. So I think, you know, it was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, great. Thank you for taking the time.
This podcast is hosted by JD, Command Prompt founder and Postgres conference chair, and is produced by me, Lindsay Hooper, director of events at Command Prompt, Inc. Command Prompt provides Postgres support, professional services, custom development, and community leadership. Since 1997, we've focused on providing just excellent service, custom tailored to your organization's needs. We'll see you soon, wherever you get your podcasts.